from 10 till 1.
Mid-mornings with Linda Ness.
Okay, this morning I'm pleased to welcome Alison Knowles from SubConquest and Matt as well, Matt Fleming, to the studio to talk about hypnotherapy. Alison is a cognitive hypnotherapist specialising in stress and anxiety and the body-mind connection in relation to healing and amazing weight loss success. And Matt is one of those successes. Welcome to Cambridge 105, Alison and Matt.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Now, Alison, first, the big question, what is hypnotherapy?
You see, I thought you might ask me this, so because we're on the radio and I want to get it right, I actually looked up the definition of hypnotherapy this morning, and I've got to say it terrified me. This is an abridged version, but in a nutshell, hypnotherapy is a state of mind whereby a therapist can easily put suggestions into somebody else's head. Well, if that's the case, then I'm surprised I've got any clients at all. It's terrifying. The way that I look at hypnotherapy is everybody that comes to me is already in a trance state, i.e. they're out of control of a situation or a behaviour, and they come to me to help them. So I actually de-hypnotise people.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting way of looking at it. And when most of us think about hypnotists, Alison, I guess we kind of think about, you know, Paul McKenna turning people into chickens and, you know, the stage hypnotist seeming to control them. Does that bear any relation to the type of hypnosis that you practice?
No, it's a completely different thing. And if you've ever actually watched a stage hypnotist, they need a huge, huge audience. And the reason that they do is they're looking for a few people that are willing to make a fool out of themselves and entertain the audience. So they'll get loads of you up on stage, and if you watch, they slowly send you back to your seat. What they're looking for is sort of the equivalent of your drunken aunt or uncle at a wedding that is happy to make an absolute fool of themselves. Because here's the thing, no hypnotist can make you do or think anything that you wouldn't naturally do. So if you are naturally an exhibitionist, that's the guy he's looking for. But no, it's nothing to do with therapeutical hypnosis.
Right, okay. And is it true that people are either susceptible to hypnosis or not? You know, are there some people that it just won't work for?
Well, again, if you sort of, the way that I look at things is everybody that comes to me is already in a trance. Trance is hypnosis. They're stuck in a pattern of behaviour or thinking. So in that respect, everybody's susceptible. There's different levels. We're all very, very different. And consequently, some people are more happy to relax and let go. It's the fear of hypnotherapy.
And yes.
That's why I hope that my approach is so much better, because I take the fear out of it. I teach you as I go and we have fun with it. And, it could help absolutely everybody.
I can imagine, because I can see from the personality that you are that it's not going to be anything heavy. It's going to be good fun. Yeah. And Matt, let's turn to you. Matt, tell us about your experience of hypnotherapy with Alison, because I understand you lost weight.
Yeah, I've tried all different types of diets. Nothing's been successful in the long term. So I thought I'd try hypnotherapy for the first time with Alison. I've now lost almost 6.5 stone by doing that in under a year, and I've not looked back since. So It's a fantastic thing to do, but you have to be open and honest with the hypnotherapist to make sure you get what you want.
What does it feel like when you're under hypnosis? You can tell me. You can tell me. Just pretend Alison's not here.
I'm not quite sure what it feels like when you're under hypnosis, but when you come out, you feel very relaxed and settled and positive about things that you don't know why. It's difficult to explain. You'd have to try it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a challenge.
to see for yourself how you feel about it.
Okay. But you can remember the whole session.
Yeah.
You don't walk in and then all of a sudden you're being woken up half an hour later with, oh God, what the hell?
I've never walked out clucking like a chicken or anything like that. It's always been good.
And how many sessions with Alison did it take?
Two sessions that for me to actually start on my journey to get where I am now. It's two sessions.
And then more after that?
I go back and see her if I feel I need to, and then just to like make sure that I'm in the right place, because I'm now doing a bike ride. I'm doing a sponsored bike ride on the 27th of April for prostate cancer. It's the Cambridge 100-mile bike ride.
Oh, yes.
So it's to just to help me that I'm focused on that with the training and everything.
Wow.
So.
But two was enough to get you kicked off on this losing stage.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That is incredible. Okay, we're going.
Obviously, everybody's different. depending on how open you are with it,
yeah,
I suppose.
But the thing is that, you know, I don't stay with you for the whole of the weight loss. My job is to make you understand what's going on. All behaviour serves a purpose. It's never about the amount you eat, it's why you're eating. And what I do is work with you to find out what it is you're doing and why. Get to the root of that, pull the root out, deal with it, and then send you off on your way. You don't need me then. You're off and going.
So, Alison, I'm just chasing down now on how you do this. So, I'm assuming that to help Matt change his eating habits, you might have had sort of planted some idea in his head. You must have.
No, I mean that's the thing. It's a really good question, because one of the fears people have about hypnotherapists is you're out of control and they plant ideas and suggestions in your head. It really cannot be done. A hypnotherapist cannot make you feel or think anything that you wouldn't naturally think. All I actually do is get Matt to, and other people that I work with, to look at what they're doing and why. And if you're trapped in a trance state, be it depression or you're eating, you can't see. And I just make you stand back, almost get yourself out of the way, and we actually have a look at it. Literally ask the question, what's that about? All behaviour serves a purpose. And once we find that behaviour, we just, you know, is there a better way of dealing with this? Can we deal with it? And once we've sorted it out, the food's not a problem anymore. The depression lifts. It's really quite magical, and it's beautiful watching the change in people.
Wow. And Matt, would you recommend hypnotherapy to other people? Do you recommend it, in fact?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I mean, I've recommended a few people to it.
Good answer, Matt.
No problem at all. That'll be the money you owe me. But no, it's a fantastic tool, you know, and it really, really has helped me to get where I am. I wouldn't have been able to get where I am without it, to be fair.
Okay, that's a great recommendation. And Alison, what on earth made you want to become a hypnotherapist? What planted that idea in your head?
Because I was a complete sceptic. I thought it was all mumbo jumbo. It was all a bit sort of hidden and spooky. But I like the idea that the power of the mind was so great. I just wondered where you could go with it. So I went along, got myself trained up. I had no intention of being a therapist, even though I was training. And then one day, the guy that was training me called me a non-therapist. And I was crestfallen, because I took that as I wasn't good enough. But what he actually meant was I'd actually taken the principle, turned it on his head, and come up with a formula that works for absolutely everybody to help them move on in hundreds and hundreds of different ways. That was it. I was hooked. I just love watching people go from moths to butterflies.
Uh-huh. I mean, I must admit, personally, I'd be one of these people, if I ever went to the Paul McKenna show, I would be hiding at the back, I'd be under a chair. I would not want to be selected. Now, I just, you know, I'm not very good at it, despite the fact I'm on the radio getting up and doing things like that. But I am a bit scared about, you know, somebody having control over me.
I, you know, I can sit here and wax lyrical, and I completely understand. And I actually do free sessions. First session's free, so I can talk people through this. But, you know, the very best way to get over this fear, and because the sessions are free of charge, first session, come and have a chat with me. Come and see what it feels like. In fact, are you game? Why don't you come along to the Hypno Hut, find out for yourself what it feels like, and then you'll be able to answer these questions for you and your listeners, and I'd be more than happy to do that.
Ooh. Okay.
You know you want to. Come on.
Okay. Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah?
I'll do that.
Oh, that'd
okay.
Be brilliant. Okay.
I'll do that. And I'll come back and report to see. Oh. I'm interested, although slightly terrified, I have to say. I like being in control. I'm a bit of a control freak.
Trust me, you know, people think about hypnotherapy and you're asleep. And as I said, I can't put ideas or thoughts in your head. You're not asleep. You're wide awake. You're talking to me. Uh-huh. If you think about it, if I put you to sleep, how could you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, I suppose
doesn't
so.
Work.
It's the images you see on the, you know, of the swinging watch and the.
it hasn't helped. It really hasn't helped. But that is a very different thing. That's pure entertainment. What I do is help people move on. And I am not in control of you. You are completely in control of a session. And I think, again, Matt's probably best place to. Did you ever feel out of control?
No, I felt in control all the time. You can hear what's being said to you. It's just very relaxed.
Yeah.
Relaxing situation that you're in, and it's, you know, it's hard to explain it without actually going along and trying it yourself.
Okay, well, I'll do that then, and I'll come back and report. And having agreed to do this, I have to ask, is it legislated in any way? Is there anything to stop its misuse?
No. I can, as Matt quite rightly said, have you clucking like a chicken on the radio next week. No.
Nothing new there.
No, it is legislated, and I would recommend, obviously, if you're interested in weight loss or stress and anxiety, I'd recommend that you sort of find a therapist who belongs to the National Council of Hypnotherapists.
Okay.
Now, you can only do that if you've sat your exams, passed all the tests, and it's an ongoing thing. We're under continual training. We have supervisors. Our supervisors have supervisors. A hypnotherapist can do no wrong. Bottom line, because they cannot do or suggest anything that isn't natural to you. But okay. It is really important to have someone that's keeping their training up and mm-hmm. keeping on top of things.
Okay, interesting. And do you think there'll ever come a time when the NHS start using this? Are they using it at the moment, in fact?
No, I mean, there's various therapies that the NHS are using. Everybody would have heard of CBT, which is behavioural therapy. Mm-hmm. It's very effective on certain people. It takes quite a long time, whereas what we do is a lot quicker and just as effective. In other countries, yes, it is part of the NHS, but not here yet. Doctors can't recommend that clients come and see me, but what they do is sort of pass them a leaflet now because they've seen the success I've had with the weight loss clients, people with diabetes, stress and anxiety, and they sort of say, well, you might want to go and see Ali. Mm-hmm. But that's as far as we've got so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this has been fascinating. And as I say, I'm going to go now. I've committed myself, haven't I? So we'll be coming back to that. How do people get in touch with you, Alison, if they're interested?
Well, I have a webpage, which is www.subconquest.co.uk. And if you go onto the internet and look up the hypnotherapy directory, every therapist on there is part of the NCH, so you're guaranteed to get a good one.
Okay. Brilliant. And Matt, I think, you know, you mentioned earlier you're doing this bike race and you've got a Just Giving page. And I think we have to give you a chance to let people know about that, because that's great. So how do you sign up?
Yeah, I'm on a Just Giving webpage. It's Just Giving, and it's the Matt's 100 for Charity bike ride. I'm doing the Cambridge 100 on April the 27th to raise money for prostate cancer.
Oh, by that time I'll be joining you, I expect, after my session.
More than welcome.
Yeah. Thank you both very, very much. Alison Knowles from Subconquest and Matt Fleming for coming in and talking to us about hypnotherapy. That's been really, really interesting.
Thank you for your time. Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From 10 till 1. Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe. Cambridge
105. Our guest has arrived in the studio. That's Anne Ward. She's Museum Manager of the Farmland Museum and Denny Abbey, a visitor attraction to be found on the A10 just north of Waterbeach. In the spotlight coming up very soon, an event, a maypole workshop. The site's kind of closed at the moment. It'll be reopening again from the 1st of April, but they do have events on, which means that they can accommodate families and children who are on half-term holiday. Anne, it's nice to have you back on the show again. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, well, last time we saw you, you were talking about the Wind in Our Sails project. That was last autumn when you came on the Wednesday mid-morning show with me. Before we start on the other topic, because you do 3 days a week with this Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, isn't it, with the Denny Abbey and Farmland Museum project. You've been working very hard on the Wind in Our Sails project, which we should explain again is the reopening, which will be happening later this year, of the Burwell windmill.
Yes,
after a heritage funding project. I think it's coming up, and I should say to you on air, actually, we're going to send a reporter down there, probably naming myself, the Sunday when you have the official opening. So yes, we should get a nice interview there.
Sunday, 13th of April.
It's coming up quickly,
welcome,
isn't it? Indeed. So that'll be at what time there?
That starts at 12 and goes on to 4. There's lots of different things to see. Speeches and ribbon cutting, 12:30 to 12:45. But we've got bread making demonstrations, children's activities, a meal trail. The forge will be operating. So there's a lot to do and see.
And it's amazing how much work has been done on the windmill too, because it's been literally stripped down, taken all the rot out. You put a new cap on, I remember you saying. It's got new sails, new shutters in the sails, which actually power it by driving the wind through the sails.
New floors, interactive querns and all different sorts of things.
I thoroughly look forward to getting along to see that one. So the reason you've come in today with your Farmland Museum hat on it is I was having a little bit of research and last night online to go on your website. We'll give out more information about the website towards the end and some contact details as well. I couldn't believe how intact Denny Abbey is. It's really a wonderful building because it was from the 14th or 15th century that it was originally put up.
12th century.
It's even older.
The nuns' refectory is 14th century.
And some of the architecture that's still extant within the building is quite superb. Some of the carvings that you've got inside there in itself, it's wonderful to behold.
Yes, when English Heritage took over the property late 40s, 50s, they started peeling back the plaster that had been put up when it became a farmhouse after Henry VIII closed it down. And they were quite amazed what they found. You've got the archways, as you said, you've got the columns and some of the figurines. But then they decided not to strip it completely back because they also wanted to show it as a history of when it was a farmhouse. Particularly the farmhouse bit that remains dates from the 18th century.
And it's quite a sizeable and substantial building in its own right, isn't it?
It's massive. And if the rest of the abbey was still standing, it would be a phenomenal,
a significant
size.
Monument, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Probably, I don't know, threatening the size of somewhere like Warwick Castle, I suppose, in its enormity.
Yes.
But a lot of people just don't realise they've got this gem or jewel on their doorstep, actually.
It's because you can't see it from the road. You drive down the A10, you have no idea. You have to come off the lane and go up the track.
So it's after Water Beach. Land Beach is on your left as you're heading north. You've got the Cambridge Business Centre, which is up on the right. You keep going nearly towards the little village of Chittering.
Past the Shell RSO garage. And then
that's on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
How far back are you, say, from the road then? As you say, and you can't actually see it.
You just can't see it at all. So you've got no idea. There's this amazing medieval building there, plus the Agricultural Museum, which is the Farmland Museum with its 17th century barn and various bits. It's only when you're there you actually realise how big the site is and what a beautiful location it is.
And why is it hidden away? It's just the sheer distance from the A10. Is that why we can't see it?
It's just when they built the A10, all around the abbey, it was all farmland. So it's obviously the stretch of land that they didn't purchase for the A10.
So English Heritage own the abbey. The Farmland Museum, though, is that run separately by a trust, isn't it?
It's independent. It's run by the Farmland Museum trustees. We're a charity, but we're not actually a trust. We're a charity. We have a guardianship agreement with English Heritage to look after the abbey, the nuns' refectory, and the 1940s cottage and the land around it. So in effect, I manage a very big open air site, which is absolutely beautiful. But it's a unique relationship.
You've got a huge team of volunteers that work beside you and under you, I guess. And plus, of course, a large number of patrons and some fairly landed gentry, aren't they? Some of the lords and sirs that also are the patrons for as trustees. You have Dr. Jane Williamson, who's the chair of the trustees.
Yes, very active.
It's a very proactive group. And the Lord Lieutenant Hugh Jubilee, he's the patron. Lord Lieutenant of Cambridgeshire, I believe, isn't he, as well? And Sir Richard Dearlove.
He as well.
Which is James Pace for that particular area of the Isle of Ely. So you've got lots of support behind you.
We have, and we've got a very good friends group as well.
So the Farmland Museum, how many years has it been open and established for?
Since 1997 at the Farmland, at Denny, but it was started at Haddenham.
In 1969, yes. By a gentleman who did no more, well, I say no more, it was very significant at the time, collecting some shards and pieces of pottery, I believe, in a box.
Yes, his sons. It was his sons who started it, then he and his wife more or less took it over, and it outgrew its space. And by pure fluke, everything came together where English Heritage wanted somebody to look after the abbey. The local farmer, John Martin, donated land for the museum. So it all worked out very nicely.
And the site, was it particularly run down when you first managed to acquire it?
It was very run down. I've just found recent photographs of what the site looked like. The 17th century barns was in ruins, the refectory was in ruins, the outbuildings were all quite run down, there was broken fences and everything. So they've done an amazing job just clearing the site. And it's a very, very popular destination for a lot of families.
Volunteering like that, sort of thing I like to do, restore, revive, pick up things, make them work again, you know, roll history back so that people can enjoy it from today.
I have a team of volunteers who are currently restoring a Ferguson tractor.
Oh, yes, a little Fergie.
Yep. They're working really hard on that. And others are looking after and restoring some of the ploughs.
And it's your trademark icon as well for the Farmland Museum, the little Fergie tractor. It's one of the things that has been etched out and sort of is the impression that leads you to the site if you go on to the website. Tell everyone about the website, really. It's dennyfarmlandmuseum.org.uk, all joined up together if you want to find some more information. And also I can give out a phone number for you as well. It's Cambridge 860988. That's the right one, isn't it, Anne? Jeez. So it's 01223 860998. So although you're closed for the winter, you're going to have a little maypole event coming up soon. You're having a tutor who's a UK expert, I guess, if not an English expert, because it's probably an English art, maypole dancing.
Yes, Mike Ruff is a leading UK expert who I've worked closely with in the past. But actually, maypole dancing is worldwide. Very strong in America, but also in the Caribbean and in Brazil. Very, very popular.
You think
and
of it as
Germany,
an English tradition, like, you know, sort of Morris men. You think of it just and beer and pubs and sunny days. You think of maypole dancing.
Exported out.
It was
16th, 17th, 18th century, all exported out.
Right. So it was us English rather than perhaps even the British who invented maypole dancing and exported it to the world.
Yes.
So you're having a workshop there on Wednesday the 26th of March. It's aimed mainly at teachers, youth and community workers and dance teachers, which I suppose in turn would be rolling it out to schools.
Yes. Anybody who would like to learn how to teach maypole dancing. So it can be a teacher, it can be a brownie guide, or it can be a scout leader or a community worker. For 3 hours, they will learn the basic steps and different dances to encourage not just children, but teenagers and adults. And it's a fun activity. You don't need to have any previous experience. And all the details are on the website.
Yep, so the website, I'll give you the details again. And thank you very much. We kind of run out of time. It's sort of as soon as we start the interview, it feels like we're kind of finishing it. But you're off to the Farmland Museum this afternoon
to do some
more work there. The website again, dennyfarmlandmuseum.org.uk. The phone number again is the Cambridge number, 860988. And you can find out about all the various events that are held right up until the end of season. When are you start again, really,
from the 1st of
April right through until...
Till the 2nd of November. And we have lots of big events throughout the year. We've got medieval nights in August. We've got people, 1940s characters take over the museum in the last May bank holiday. We have crafts. We have all sorts of things going on, and we have children's activities throughout the summer and school holidays.
Great place to take the kids if they get bored. So we have some nice English summer weather, some good British climb for the summer. You can get the kids out and up there just off the A10, just before Chittering and after Waterbeach. And if you're interested in this maypole workshop, that takes place between 9:30 and 12:30 on Wednesday the 26th of March in the Farmland Museum's 17th century barn. Must get up there, Anne, and have a look around.
Like to see you there.
Thanks very much. And I shall see you at the windmill in Burwell coming up in 3 weeks. Well, it's just under 3 weeks' time, isn't it? It would be three or four weeks' time. We'll see you over there to get a report off to the listeners too. Anne, thank you very much for coming in and seeing us this morning.
All about the city.
Cambridge 105. Now, American singer-songwriter Janice Ian comes to the Cambridge Corn Exchange on Wednesday the 26th of March. It's part of a double bill with Tom Paxton. And Janice is perhaps best known for her hit at 17, but as I discovered when I met her, it wasn't a smooth path to stardom, and this song.
I learned the truth at 17, their love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired.
So, Janice, let's talk about early family life to start with.
I think I'm a pretty typical second-generation American. My parents were first generation. Their parents were Russian and Polish who'd fled sometime between 1910 and 1925. So I grew up in a family of a lot of stories, a lot of myths, a lot of singing. Everybody sort of forgot to tell me that things were different for women than they were for men. And I was raised to think that I could pretty much be whatever I wanted. If it was an astronaut or president of the United States, it was well within reach if I just looked hard enough. My goal was to be a lifeguard in the summers and a veterinarian in the winter and do music in between. And so, you know, I've got a third of that done. I started writing songs when I was 12, and I think I started off with A Piece of Luck with Hair of Spun Gold because it's a very well-written song, and then wrote a series of just horrible songs, and then wrote Society's Child. And I was sitting on a bus on my way to my guidance counselor's, I think. I was in sixth grade or something, seventh, so I was 13 and a half, 14. I just got the idea for a song about a black boy showing up at the door of his white girlfriend and being told to go away, and the song grew out of that. It wasn't anything that had happened to me. I actually didn't have much interest in dating, but I was seeing it happen a lot around me, and I was living in an all-black neighborhood, so I was always the only white kid at the party, and I was real cognizant of race because of that, I think, and because my parents were real involved in the civil rights movement in America. Society's Child was one of 10 or 12 songs that I played for Shadow Morton, a producer in New York. And I came to see him because I'd met Reverend Gary Davis through a guitarist, and I used to hang around his house and watch him play and steal, you know, like artists do. And his wife really liked me. And she would make chicken, and I would eat her chicken, and it was great. She was like my grandmother. She told this guy at the Gaslight Cafe that he had to put me on to open for Gary. And the guy said no, and she said, well, fine, Reverend won't play, it's all right. So he put me on, and I sang my little three songs, and I was thrilled. You know, I was 14 and a half. And this guy came up and said, I'm going to make you a star. And I had seen enough movies that I went, yeah, right. And he said, no, I'll meet you tomorrow. And he took me literally to a lawyer who took me to a producer who turned out to be Shadow. And I played 10 or 12 songs. And he said, fine, we'll cut that one. Let's rename it Society's Child. And I said, fine. And then I went home, and they called me a couple of days later and said, did I want anything in the studio? And I thought about it because I thought, well, these idiots are going to rent something for me. So I said, yeah, I wanted a harpsichord and a 12-string. And they went ahead and rented them. So I thought, well, now I've got to find some reason to have the harpsichord. So I wrote this introduction. So I walked into the studio with no clue of how this worked. They introduced me to the musicians, and I said, right, here's the introduction. And they all kind of looked at me, and I just kept going. So they went ahead and played what I told them to play. It was great. It was a great first record experience for me because it set me up assuming that I was allowed to run the record, that I was allowed to run the studio, that I was the one who instructed the musicians. I didn't know for years that that was in any way abnormal.
Walk me down to school, baby. Everybody's acting deaf in the line until they turn and say, why don't you stick to your own One of these days I'm gonna stop my listening, gonna raise my head up high. One of these days I'm gonna raise up my glistening wings and fly. But that day will have to wait for a while. Baby, I'm only society's child. When we're older, things may change, but for now, this is the way they must remain. I say I can't see you anymore, baby. I can't see you anymore, no. I don't want to see you anymore, baby.
Canadian documentary maker saw me do a show, and he brought the record to the attention of Leonard Bernstein, who listened to it and said, well, I want to feature her on my show. And then he found out I was 15, and he was, I must feature her on my show. And he featured me at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, you know, when there were only four channels to watch. And the next day, all of a sudden, we had a huge hit. And it heralded that whole era, all the protest songs. Outside of Blowing in the Wind, there wasn't another one before it that I'm aware of in the States. Because the aftermath of it was astounding. A radio station was burned for playing it. People were fired left and right. It became a real civil rights cause to be a program director who would put that record on, or a disc jockey would put that record on and then live with the consequences. And people had their jobs destroyed. People were hounded out of town for playing that record. In that sense, it had enormous consequences, obviously, on my life. You know, it showed me very quickly the power of music.
What about the impact on you as Janice Ian, the teenage prodigy? I mean, there must have been extraordinary complications there because of it.
There's complications when you're a teenager, period, you know, and then if you add to that having a hit record and you add to that having a hit record like Society's Child, on my life the effect was enormous. I mean, I was the hope of a generation. I was supposed to be the new Dylan. I was the new this, the new that. And I got to meet lots of people like Ella Fitzgerald and people like that that ordinarily I wouldn't have gotten the chance to meet. But I was already hanging out with people like Joplin and Hendrix and them. You know, that was very much the crowd that hung out in the Village, and it was all the same circuit. I think by the time I was 17 years old, I walked off a stage at Philharmonic Hall in New York and announced to my then manager that I was quitting because it wasn't fun anymore. And she laughed and said, well, they all say that. And I said, well, I don't care, but I am quitting. I finished my work and then proceeded to have a major breakdown. Played the part of a drooling imbecile for a month and went into pretty good therapy, and was real lucky that I had a therapist who was the old school. He just was really concerned with putting me back together as a human being and helping me find out what I wanted to do with my life. And I moved to Los Angeles about a year and a half later, really to get away from my family and the East Coast and everything that I knew, and to go somewhere where I'd be totally on my own and to write. I didn't know if I was a writer yet. You know, I really didn't know how to get out of looking at myself in the mirror and going, I don't really like what I see, and turning that into, I like that. So I apprenticed in Philadelphia when I was living there at Bell Sound. I learned how to use a microphone. I learned what my voice could do and couldn't do. I learned all the stuff that I didn't know, and then I went to LA and lived with a small TV and a guitar. Out of that, I wrote Stars, and then I wrote Jesse during that period. And all of a sudden, between Stars and Jesse, I decided that maybe I really could call myself a writer.
Jesse, come home. There's a hole in the bed where we slept. Now it's growing cold. Hey, Jesse, your face in the place where we lay by the hearth, all apart, it hangs on my heart. And I'm leaving the light on the stairs. No, I'm not scared. I wait for you. Hey, Jesse, I'm lonely, come home.
Jesse, the floors and the boards, recalling your steps. And I remember too, all the pictures are fading and shaded in gray, but I still set a place on the table at noon. And I'm leaving light on the stairs. No, I'm not scared. I wait for you. Hey, Jesse, I'm lonely. Come home. Jesse, the spread on the bed is like when you left. I've kept it up for you, and all the blues and the greens have been recently cleaned, and it's seemingly new. Hey, Jess, me and you will swallow the light on the stairs. We'll do up my hair and sleep unaware. Hey, Jesse, I'm lonely. Come home.
Jesse? Jesse doesn't exist. I mean, for me, Jesse is the person in the song. They always are. I would hate to tie a song down to a specific person. If Jesse did exist, I don't think I'd talk about him, because it would make him mine. And I don't think songs should do that. Not my songs. It's the same problem as doing a video of a song like Jesse. You tie it down to a face and then it no longer belongs to the person hearing it. A video of At 17. I mean, At 17 belongs to who hears it. It's very important that it stay that way.
Let's talk about the impact on you of Roberta Flack recording Jesse, because everybody turned their backs, hadn't they?
When Roberta Flack recorded Jesse, what it did for me was give me instant credibility again, because up until that point, the entire music industry had pretty much said, you're used up, you're a has-been. You know, and I was 20, 21. Roberta cutting Jesse said to them, wait a minute, she's a credible songwriter. You can make money off this. So all of a sudden, some doors opened here and there.
What did you actually think to her interpretation?
It was amazing to me that Roberta felt strongly enough about that song that she made it her own. I mean, it was the same when Aznavour did it. He translated it into French and recorded it, and it was amazing because he felt it was universal enough that it could become a French song. That's an honor. Any way you cut it, it's an honor.
I learned the truth at 17, their love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned
the mid-70s obviously brought the prosperity which you'd been long waiting for with At 17. Now, was it a song that was actually waiting to be written?
I don't know that 17 was a song waiting to be written. I suppose somebody would have written it sooner or later, but it was just for me part and parcel of the ethic that I started trying to develop with Stars of writing songs that would be honest and true and authentic and at the same time tell a story that would be interesting to people who hadn't experienced it without bleeding all over everybody. the key to me of 17 and the part of it that I like is that at the end it's implied that it's an ugly duckling, therefore it becomes a swan. You know, and I think that's what critics tend to miss about that song, but that's what fans tend to get about the song. It's a redemption. Billie Holiday said a great thing once. Somebody said, your songs are so sad, and she said, oh, but there's always hope in them. And I think that's very important in a song, you know, in my kind of song, because if you have a song without hope, you're really ending it for people. And you can't. It should be a circle, she said profoundly.
In those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems, it's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, they only get what they deserve.
After 17 came out, and we had trouble getting it played at first because it was a slow song and it wasn't a drive time song and it wasn't this, that, and the other. But then when it started to become a hit and it was obvious that it was going to become a huge hit, one of the things that started happening was that every Valentine's Day I would get all these Valentines from strangers. And it was just great because one year I got like 700 Valentines. And it was really wonderful that everybody who didn't get Valentines sent me one. Everybody who felt an outcast had a chance to make someone else feel warm. You know, it was great.
In the rich relation'd hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. Remember those who win the game, lose the love they sought to gain. Debentures of quality and dubious integrity. The small town eyes will gape at you in dull surprise when payment due exceeds accounts received at 17.
Can you still associate with those words as having come from you?
Yeah, I think that I sing 17 every show. And I think it would be a real rip-off if I didn't. I think it would be terribly unfair to the people who are coming because of that song. I still associate with it the same as anyone else because, first of all, there's plenty of days I get up, look in the mirror and go, oh, no, why can't I just spackle my makeup on and leave it, you know? And second of all, because I think part of the job as a writer is to stay in touch with yourself. And certainly that 17-year-old and 14-year-old and 12-year-old who couldn't afford the clothes that everybody else was wearing and never quite got it straight, how to get my hair to look like everyone else's. I mean, when I grew up, everyone had straight hair. Nobody had curly hair. I just went through such enormous horrors to try and get straight hair, you know, sleeping in big rollers, ironing, I mean, whatever it took. And I remember when I first started doing TV, people trying at the TV stations to straighten my hair, and I finally got real defensive and would say, no, leave it, it's curly. And now, of course, you know, it's become very chic to have curly hair, and people are always going, is yours natural? And I think, God, I was such an outcast because of my hair as a kid. So I stay in touch with all of that. And the thing about singing at 17 now, where it's more, I can look at it and I can smile at myself, it's not painful anymore because those years do end. And you reach the point where you go, this is the face I have. This is the body I have. And you know what? It's okay. There's people who love this face and this body. I like them all right. You reach that point in your life, and it's a very calming thing to reach. But I don't think you ever lose that sense of wishing that you did look like someone else, you know?
were never called when choosing sites for basketball. It was long ago and far away. The world was younger than today, and dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like
listening to my conversation with Janice Ian. And Janice comes to the Cambridge Corn Exchange Wednesday, the 26th of March. It's a double bill because performing together on stage in the UK for the very first time, she comes with Tom Paxton. They've called the gig Together at Last, and it will present Tom Paxton and Janice Ian singing all their best-known songs. And, of course, we now know that she is going to sing at 17, plus a whole host more of their individual material and together as well. Now, each, of course, with ties to the classic Greenwich Village folk scene, Tom and Janice, nearly a generation apart, I reckon. Yet they share a slew of folk influences as well as an affinity for fearlessly tackling controversial issues, one of which, of course, we raised in that interview with Janice. So, Janice Ian, Cambridge Corn Exchange, a double bill with Tom Paxton, Wednesday the 26th of March, and the gig gets underway at 7:30. If you want to phone up to check for ticket availability, it's Cambridge, that's 01223 3578. 51, or of course you can use all the W's, Cambridge Corn Exchange, to go online to book your tickets for that. But that coming up on Wednesday the 26th of March.